My name is Ed Goldberg, and I am speaking with Laura Lipman. Laura, welcome back to Portland.
Oh, it's great to be here. I love Portland.
Yeah, we love you too. The title of your latest book is Another Thing to Fall. And before we go any further, I will say it is a Tess Monahan book.
So. It is, the 10th in the series.
Yes, and it's published by William Morrow. We were chatting just before we went on about Baltimore, and that Baltimore always features in your books. I mean, it's another character in your books, really.
Absolutely.
Yes. But we were talking specifically about two things. We were talking about your husband, David Simon, who is the producer and one of the writers of The Wire.
Mm-hmm.
And although I've only seen season one, it's really superior stuff. But this book in some way touches on that as well, and we'll get to that in a bit, right?
Good. Yeah. Yes, it does. It touches on what it's like to have a bird's eye view of a television show in production in Baltimore.
Well, you got more than a, or Tess got more than a bird's eye view. She got a worm's eye view. She was there on the ground. So the other thing was John Waters. And I do want to do a couple of minutes on John Waters because he is, when I talk about great American filmmakers with a vision, you know, once you get past Charlie Chaplin and John Ford and Stanley Kubrick, I always mention John Waters and people just roll their eyes. Now, what do you think?
John Waters is a unique talent, and he is a really smart man, and there is a mix of things in his work that are once, you know, yes, he likes to celebrate certain outrageous things, and you know, he once proposed that the city of Baltimore put out a bumper sticker that would read, "Come to Baltimore and be shocked." And he likes to shock people, it's true. And if you've read, I have a bad memory, so I won't remember, but he's written very well in great detail about some of the real pulpmeisters of the 50s, some of the people who did over-the-top horror films and played gimmicks in the theaters with their audiences.
Oh, yes. The guy did the shocking under the seats.
Yes,
and
yes.
I can't remember his name. It's a three-named director.
One of those things.
Herschel Gordon Lewis.
That's it. Right.
Yes,
he's written a lot about Herschel Gordon Lewis.
And Russ Meyer.
So, you know, he's a really smart man. He has a very broad and deep understanding of the history of film. And he, you know, in Baltimore, we basically have this holy trinity of culture, Barry Levinson, Ann Tyler, and John Waters. And I mean, increasingly, given how much ink was spilled on The Wire this time around, I guess David Simon is horning in there.
But and what about Laura Lipman? She's not part of this.
I can't put myself up that high.
Here?
But what's funny about it is of the three artists who are most associated with Baltimore, Ann Tyler, Barry Levinson, and John Waters. Ann Tyler, I think, is a great novelist, a world-class novelist. She's a Pulitzer Prize winner, one of the best contemporary novelists. I think Baltimore is incidental in her work. She's not writing about Baltimore. She's writing stories that are set there, but that's not part of her mission.
I agree.
Levinson writes about a Baltimore that's long gone, and this is problematic for me, it's overwhelmingly white and male.
Mm-hmm.
That is Levinson's world. It's what he knew. Women and minorities are simply not part of the mainstream in most of his films. And then you have John Waters, and I think John Waters, of the three, is the true Baltimore voice. And sometimes it's tacky, and sometimes it's outrageous. I'll tell you this, it's in the films of John Waters that you're going to hear the most authentic Baltimore accents and just see little details that you won't see in any other Baltimore film.
Hey, I'm from Baltimore and I read through the coats.
Pretty good.
Not bad, huh?
Not bad.
I lived in D.C., you know, And I used to escape to Baltimore, and I love the Baltimore accent. The one last thing I want to say about John Waters is that he is an exceedingly humane individual. He's a person whose work started out being just funny and poking people in the eye, and he's become a humanist of world-class proportions. His stories are all about the freedom of the human spirit and what it's like to be different in a world of people that ignore you.
And, Peter, I couldn't express it better myself. I think you're right.
Okay, let's talk about your book, because what happens here is that Tess Monahan, your protagonist for how many books now? Seven,
ten.
Eight? Ten books with Tess. You said that before. She used to be a reporter on something like the Baltimore Sun.
She was a reporter at Baltimore's last surviving newspaper, yes.
Yes. And now she's a PI,
yes.
A for real PI.
And a getting to be better PI. I mean, she's started off kind of rocky. The readers have had a chance to see her learn on the job. She's getting pretty good at what she does.
Mm-hmm. You also write standalones, and I have to say that I've really enjoyed your standalones. The Power of Three was a wonderful book.
Oh, thank you.
And I kind of wish you had toured into town on that one, or maybe you did and I couldn't see you or something. But
I think I did, actually. I think that's the last time I came to Portland is when I was touring for To the Power of Three. Now, the standalones, sometimes you just get lucky, you know, and what I got lucky in is that I had the kind of career where the test novels were doing well enough so that I could quit my job, but they weren't doing so well, so phenomenally well, that my publisher wouldn't allow me to do anything else. And so when I wanted to start writing standalones, they were like, sure, write standalones. And I began alternating the standalones and the test books and finding that each contributed to the other, both in terms of the audience it brought me, but also in terms of what it brought me as a writer. And I would learn to do things in the standalones, and I would take those back to the test books, and then I would go to the standalones. And the standalones are very dark, and I use up the characters, and the characters use up me. The end of the year when I've been working on a standalone, I'm wiped out. Then I go back to Tess, who's like an old friend, and I'm always happy to be with her again. And while I don't know the stories, and I am by no means having an easy, I've never had an easy time writing a book. I think you should be suspicious if it's easy. That's when you know you're in trouble. But I know Tess and I know her universe, and I'm always glad to be back there. And Tess has what I call a rueful optimism about the human condition. And she does believe at heart that some people are okay. She won't go as far as Anne Frank. She won't say that people are basically good. But she believes that more people than not might surprise you sometimes with how nice they can be and what their potential is.
Well, Anne Frank wrote that before she got taken to the camp also.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. One of the greatest ironic statements of our times.
Can I, a personal observation, having read both your test books, since she was living above a bookstore in a donated room, your standalones, I think, I think the reason they take more out of you is that they're literature. Your test books are, well, Graham Greene, his novels and his entertainments. I think your test books are more like entertainments, and your standalones are more like good novels, great novels even.
Here's the way I prefer to talk about it, because I'm always afraid that when you get into that Graham Greene territory, you're inviting enormous hubris.
Go for it.
When I'm writing my standalones, I'm going for really big home runs. Big home runs. I'm putting it out there as an all or nothing risk. I'm either going to hit the home run or I am going to be, you know, I'm going to strike out looking when I go for the standalones. When I'm writing the test books, I like to think of myself as that famous Baltimore Oriole, Wee Willie Keeler.
Oh, yes.
Master of the Baltimore
From the chop. Old Baltimore Orioles.
From the old Baltimore Orioles.
The minor league Baltimore Orioles.
And as you know, Wee Willie Keeler was one of the most successful baseball players of his time, with a terrific batting average and a terrific on-base percentage. And part of that was because of something called the Baltimore chop, where he would lay down a ground ball that bounced so high and he was so fast that he could get to base before it was fielded. And I think of the Tess Monahan books as really good Baltimore chops. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get on base. They're going to be satisfying. That's my hope. I want to write something that succeeds as a mystery, where there's suspense and you don't know what's going on. I want them to be funny in a way, to the extent that crime novels can be funny, because I don't think we should ever lose sight of the fact that people have died and there has been violence and that there are real life serious consequences to those things all the time. And the thing is that I can't use Tess up if she's going to keep going. She can't go through the sort of harrowing life experiences that people go through in the standalones, because then she couldn't come back. So I like that variety. And I mean, I'm flattered beyond all get out that you think so highly of my standalones. The other thing too is that I like writing a book a year. You know, it's really funny. People say, oh, I can't believe you do that. I said, well, don't you go to work every day? I go to work every day. I think that's the right thing to do. I work Monday through Friday. I work hard. But after a standalone, I would need 6 months off to just even think about going back to work, because I'm really wrung out. I can go back to Tess after a standalone And it's almost a healing thing for me.
We Willie Killer also said something which can be the secret of anybody's success, which is hit them where they ain't.
Exactly. Hit them where they ain't. Yeah. And you know, when I started out, they weren't in Baltimore. You know, when I started out, the only thing that was known for being in Baltimore was the television show Homicide. Mm-hmm. And there were so many American cities that had more than one series of books being written there. Baltimore was strangely bereft.
Well, I have to tell you, living 18 years in Washington, D.C., an artificial city by any standard, there's no, I mean, there are neighborhoods there, but they're not real neighborhoods. There's no Little Italy, you know, a natural enclave of people who've gotten together because they want to be together. They're either forced together by high rents or they're there, you know, for government jobs or something like that. That I used to escape to Baltimore all the time to see and touch real people. I used to go to the old Lexington Market.
It's still there, and it still has the best crab cake in the city by my lights.
Man, I'd drive up in there in the morning, and I'd have oysters for breakfast.
And then hungry.
Yes, I know. And then stick around and have crab cakes for lunch. And before they gussied up Inner Harbor, which is quite beautiful, don't get me wrong. I like going there. Yeah, that was a trip going down there because it was pretty much a hellhole.
It was. Old Riding Piers. There was this old restaurant on one of the piers, Connolly's. I used to actually go there with my family, so I did know the Inner Harbor before it was glitzed up. Baltimore has this dangerous affection for nostalgia. It really is the local disease. So I try not to look backwards with too much longing. And I understand as a citizen and a taxpayer that it's good to have high-rise condos with people who can afford to pay the property taxes, and that all goes into the city. But there are moments when I look around Baltimore now and I see these high rises and they create shadows and canyons and places that used to be so open with water views forever. I'm a little wistful.
Well, you know, you're preaching to the choir here because, as you noticed, I'm wearing a jacket that says Brooklyn Dodgers. So
you also have the disease.
I do, don't I? Yes. And for Baltimore, too, come to think of it. Gee whiz, we're halfway through already. I want to remind our listeners I'm speaking with Laura Lippman, who is a delight to talk to under any circumstances.
Thank you.
Love talking to you. Title of her latest Tess Monahan book is Another Thing to Fall, William Morrow. Tess is hired to be security on a TV show. They're filming a TV show in Baltimore. I don't remember. What's the title of the show? I've forgotten.
Oh, it's called Man of Steel.
Man of Steel.
Because it's about a steelworker whose last name is Mann. And he gets hit on the head, and as you do when you get a hit on the head, he begins time traveling and finds himself in the early 19th century falling in love with a real historical figure, Betsy Patterson, who in the real world was to go on to marry and then be divorced from the younger brother of Napoleon, Jerome Bonaparte.
That sounds like a made-up thing, Jerome Bonaparte. It's like Melvin Bonaparte. is true, though.
That's the true part. Betsy and Jerome are the true part. Everything else was made up.
Okay, so your experience with whatever, you know, experience you had with The Wire has features very heavily in this because you probably knew nothing about TV production before that started.
I knew nothing. I mean, I sort of fell into this relationship with someone who then fell into having a television show. He didn't have the television show when we started dating, or it came about the same time that we decided to live together. And I knew very little about it. Most people know very little about it. The main thing I didn't know is that it was extremely hard work, extremely long days with a lot of tedium. And I had never really thought about how many, the various things that can affect a day of shooting. Things that are, I mean, it's not just people, it's weather, it's light. The local city government can be an enormous pain if they choose to be. Citizens can be a problem. All sorts of things happen. And I got a view of that. Now, the thing is that The Wire was a pretty harmonious show where people genuinely liked one another. And it was written and produced, for the most part, by people who were from Baltimore. There were no There were no sort of true Hollywood people on The Wire, so it didn't make for much of a culture clash. And so for my purposes, I had to create too much more, I would say, archetypal Hollywood slicksters, people who are not from the city, who don't get the city, and are really just using it as a backdrop. And, you know, you mentioned that Baltimore is important to my work. I think it's fair to note that when you see characters in my novels who don't get Baltimore, watch out for them. They either bad things are going to happen to them or they're going to do bad things. Mm-hmm. And they're going to get their comeuppance.
If you've seen a bumper sticker that says eat Bertha's muscles, you don't really know Baltimore. But if you know where to get good pit beef, you really know Baltimore.
Right, that's true. That's a good point. If you know where to get good pit beef and, eat Bertha's muscles. It's a lovely place. It's a nice place. But it's not. It's only the tip of the Baltimore iceberg.
The most exposed tip, because you see those bumper stickers even out here on the West Coast. So I think you had a lot of fun. Whatever was going on with the mystery, and I mean, to me, the mystery is receding as I'm thinking about these characters. You have the most fun with the two leads, a woman named Celine Waits, young woman, an underage young woman. We'll talk about her in a second, and Johnny Tampa. And I kept thinking of, is this Johnny Depp gone to seed? I mean, what is he?
You know, it's funny because I'm used to the fact that in Baltimore, people are always trying to find real people in my characters. Mm-hmm. This is the first time that I began writing about people that I saw a national audience would be trying to find the real life antecedents. And I just sort of accept that game is played. I really don't work that way. I thought people were going to think that Johnny Tampa was Luke Perry from the old Beverly Hills 90210, someone who had a huge hit television show and never found success in the movies. I mean, Johnny Depp, terrific actor who's found a lot of success in the movies and, to my knowledge, has no weight problem, unlike poor Johnny Tampa, who burst through two pairs of pants in one day. And I thought people would look at Celine Waits and think of any number of these young girls gone wild, whether it was they might think about Lindsay Lohan. Although if you're reading carefully, there's some indications that Celine Waits is very much her own person and should not be confused with any of these young starlets.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things that happens as the layers of each character get peeled away is that more and more is revealed about them, and sometimes it's not as bad as you think.
I will say this much, and it's borderline spoilerish, but maybe not.
What the hell?
Because I was around a television show for as long as I was, and because I know a large number of actors. What I know about actors is they might be high maintenance. They might be a little bit on the self-centered side in some cases, although not in all cases. The one thing they seldom are is just stupid. You don't meet a lot of stupid actors. What they do is specialized, and it takes an unusual skill set, and intelligence is actually part of the job.
One of the things you quote in here is the real quote from Alfred Hitchcock about actors and cattle. He didn't say actors are cattle. He said actors should be moved around like cattle. Yeah, so he didn't think that actors were dumb cows. He just thought that you needed to herd them and get them to do what you wanted to do, right?
Yes, exactly, which is what you do need to do. And I mean, you know, sometimes actors will be obstinate or difficult about line readings or the way they think something should go. But there's always conflict.
One of the things about Tess is that she's, I guess closet intellectual is not the right word, because her intellectual is all over her like spines on a porcupine. She's offended by misquotes from things where, you know, people are overreaching by trying to remember things that they never really read. She's offended by historical inaccuracies when she knows the difference.
Right. And she's not offended by her own. But
not exactly.
All people, she's not the least bit offended by her own ignorance.
Yeah, that's I always say the only hypocrisy I can stand is my own. So I really get a kick out of her. She's even fussy about these things sometimes, and I find that endearing about her.
Early in the book, part of Tessa's behaviors is explained is that the answer is she's 34 going on 70. Mm-hmm. You know, she is precociously cranky. She's way too stuck in her own habits and ruts and routines. And I think the one thing that saves her is she does have a sense of humor about herself. She does catch herself, and she does realize from time to time that she can be as ridiculous as all these other people that she's, you know, keeping a running commentary on in her own head.
Now, here's something that would indicate something about her. Talk about being stuck in routines. How does she get the job with the TV show? I mean, it's because of one of her routines.
One of her routines is Tess's. She rows. She's out sculling, and she has chosen to scull while wearing a headset and a Sony Walkman because her boyfriend is on a local radio show. Which, you know, if you think about it, you're already going backwards into the world with, you know, you don't have a coxswain when you're in a scull. So it's a pretty risky thing to do, but she's rationalized. And that's actually a very important line in the book, which is when Tess rationalized her way into it, which she later decided is how everyone gets into trouble. That's a big theme of mine, is that I don't write mad scientist, evil genius types. I attempt to write, I guess I should never make any claim for my work, but at least make a claim for what I'm trying to do, is I want to write recognizably human people who in very incremental ways have started to do things that they could never have imagined themselves doing. If you had said to one of the characters in this book, you're going to end up killing someone one day, he never could have seen that in himself. He works his way there very slowly. You know, he has what he thinks are reasons, but you know, the fact is he loses it. And so yes, Tess goes rowing backwards and she bumbles into a shot. And you know, if you know very much about television production, they're trying to shoot the sunrise, which is enormously tricky. You only have so long to do it, and they're shooting it from water, and they've got police boats, and you know, it's taken immense amount of effort to set up this shot. And Tess comes right into it and wrecks it.
Mm-hmm. Good for her, I say.
You know, the book was, you know, there's always rewriting. Originally, the first line of the book was, they met cute.
Ooh. Nice editing job. Tess is asked to be security on this thing. For what reason? What's going on this set that is unnerving them?
Lots of little things seem to be going wrong. There are little fires that never amount to much but are clearly arson. There was Nair in the leading man's cold cream. If he had put it on, if he hadn't smelled it first, he would have ended up removing his eyebrows.
That's nasty. Burning his skin, too.
Yeah, yeah, nasty stuff. There's a community activist who's making lots of noise. There are disgruntled steelworkers who feel that their industry isn't being portrayed correctly, although maybe their real beef is that no one got hired on as a consultant. You know, it might be part of the old State and Main shakedown. So there are all these little problems. And there also has been a suicide. And when police investigate the suicide, they find that the man had several photographs of the actress at the center of the show. And there's nothing overtly wrong, but it's all kind of creepy. And so they're worried about, or that's how it's put to test at least. Maybe that's not the whole story after all, but it's put to test that they're worried about Celine and they would like her to be her bodyguard in essence.
Well, here's a question. This is not strictly germane to the book, but I'm curious what you think about this. Have we become too sensitized to this kind of thing with the internet, with Homeland Security, with danger level orange, living with this stuff for so long? Are we oversensitized to something that might actually be innocent? Do we fail to recognize innocence anymore?
I think that's a great question, because it's something I play with in the book. In that very opening prologue, it's written in such a way, I know where people's thoughts will go. I just know how people think now. I know what we're primed to worry about. And so that's where people go at the beginning of the book. And that's very deliberate, because that's not at all what's going on.
How do you feel about that? I mean, do you let it bother you in your day-to-day life? You don't even think about it, do you?
I think about a lot of things a lot. I'm actually, you know, a bit of a... I'm home a lot. So I'm kind of like the cranky old lady who screams at people for running the stop sign in front of my house and who notices suspicious activity. And, you know, I'm turning into the neighborhood busybody, which... The position is vacant since my neighbor moved, and he was a great guy. He sort of saw everything, and he retired and moved down to South Carolina. So as the next oldest person on the block, I'm stepping into his
That's
shoes.
That's great. You're the mayor of the street, are
so,
you?
So, I do pay attention, but I also think, you know, keep coming back to this issue of nostalgia. We're crazy if we think a lot of the things we worry about now weren't always there. Now, they weren't talked about as much. Certain human behavior has always been with us. There's a fascinating piece in the New York Times yesterday written by the crime writer Harlan Coben, who's a good friend, and it was in defense of spyware on your kid's computer. And he brought up an issue that I know is a concern among a lot of my friends with teenage sons, which is there is definitely a difference between being a 13-year-old in 1968 going out and getting a copy of Playboy and being a 13-year-old exploring pornography on the internet. You know, Playboy looks so innocent.
Oh,
and,
it is.
And no one's parents ever really minded. They understood that you needed the secret, and you know, hiding it under your bed and having your own little secret was part of it, and parents sort of participated. For the most part, I'm sure there are some parents who were horrified, but for the most part, parents participated in the charade of, you know,
being shocked.
Of being shocked if they caught you with it. Nowadays, I mean, there is that. There is this portal to some pretty ugly stuff. Away from the computer screens, going about our lives, there's very little new under the sun when it comes to human nature.
Yeah, I always wonder whether there's more of it now or whether we just hear about it more, and whether people have permission now. I use that word in quotes, that it, whatever your kink, you know there's somebody out there, because you've seen a website for people who are just like you, so begin to think maybe you're not as abnormal as you might have believed at one time.
Do you know there's a website that's actually devoted to photographs of naked women sitting on large rubber balls, because apparently that's somebody's fetish? I heard about this on the radio.
Do you know that there's a website out there devoted to pictures of Jewish women smoking? You think I'm making that up?
No, but I love it. I might go to that one. I want to see that one. It doesn't really serve me as a fetish, but I'm very curious now.
Yes. I mean, and why Jewish women and why smoking?
And how can they tell that they're Jewish women?
I mean,
they
sent the central casting, you know, send me a dark woman with a big nose and make sure she's a smoker. I mean, you know, whatever you kink is, there's something out there for you. Harlan Coben wrote a book called Tell No One, they made a French film out of it, very good.
It's not very good.
I emailed back and forth with Harlan about that because, when all of this is said and done in your book, another thing to fall, the motive is revenge, as it is in many, 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 many books and many, many things in life. The motive ultimately is someone who feels they have been wronged and needs to get an accounting and maybe needs to pay back.
Needs to be seen, needs to be, it's about acknowledgement. This is something I'm really interested in, and it plays up in this book in a lot of ways. There's sort of a light and dark version of it. The light version is this older woman who comes to Tess's class on being a private detective, and she's widowed, and she's a woman of some size, and she wears big flowery dresses. But because she's a woman in our culture and she's over 60, she's essentially invisible. And it turns out that that makes her a prodigy at surveillance, and that she has this untapped talent to follow people because no one ever sees her. That's the light version of it. And then there's this other character who also hasn't been seen and hasn't been acknowledged, and he's desperate for it. He's so desperate for, I'm going to keep using the word acknowledgement because it's the most general word I can use without revealing anything. And the acknowledgement itself becomes the quest, like, see me, listen to me, listen to me. At the end of the book, all he really wants is to be heard by someone neutral, by someone fair, who might concede that he has a point, that he has been wronged. And, you know, I actually find this all very credible. You know, no, it goes a little bit further in the book than it may ever go in real life, but I actually meet people like this all the time.
Gee whiz, we have to stop there, actually a little over time. Another Thing to Fall by Laura Lippman, published by Morrow. It's always great talking to you.
Oh, it's so much fun to see you, Ed. Okay. You know I love this.
Come back again.
Okay.